It's hard to know just where to begin with the aftermath of the Oxford High shootings.
I always err on the side of facts first, making sure they understand the harm and reality that is out there, because it's more important for them to come home at night than to give some type of a false assurance that this won't happen to them.
If we can get our hands around the harm done, maybe we can finally move to make schools safer. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We just heard the voice of Darian Driver Hudson. She's the president and CEO of United Way of Southeastern Michigan. And we were talking to her about mental health response to the Oxford shootings. But Dr. Hudson also used to be a teacher and a school superintendent. The events at Oxford High brought forth her own experience and response to gun violence.
Sadly, when I was superintendent, I lost on average 2 students a month to gun violence, whether it was on school grounds or, you know, at home or in neighborhoods. And so it was a community conversation around gun safety. We cannot forget that violence is occurring at all levels. There's 2 names that I remember most distinctly from the children that I lost. And the first is Sierra Guyton. She was a 9-year-old who was killed on a school playground. She was playing after school and she caught a stray bullet as an innocent bystander. This was maybe 4 o'clock in the afternoon in the springtime of 2014. And then Zalea Jenkins was the other. She was sitting on her grandfather's lap and caught a stray bullet and was killed at her home. And I remember her mother gave these teddy bears that had her name on it and said, "Remember Zalea." And I can never forget. I can never forget their names. I can never forget the very difficult decisions, unpopular decisions that have to be made, have to be discussed about keeping schools safe, metal detectors, security cameras, student IDs, all of these different things that really cause a lot of uproar are so necessary in keeping our children safe. Having close relationships with schools and city governments and police departments is essential. And these are things that are difficult to talk about right now. But April, we must, because one child passing is too many.
Another thing that I think confounds a lot of people at moments like this is what we're saying to our kids about what's going on. Parents wrestle with whether we need to impress on them the importance of knowing what to do, either if someone brings a gun to school or if they find themselves, God forbid, in an active shooter situation? Or is it better to try to protect the sense of safety that kids should feel and mostly do feel about the place where they spend most of their waking hours? Do you have thoughts on that balance?
You know, one thing that we used to always say is if you see something, you must say something. And it sounds so simple, but we have to make it socially acceptable for our children to feel comfortable going to an adult, going to an authority figure if something is wrong, if there's a danger, a possibility of danger. I think oftentimes we're so quick to, you know, call our children snitches or, you know, that they're tattletales if they're younger. But I think that we have to get to the place where children understand it's a necessity to come forward if they see something that could cause harm or danger. They have a friend that has insinuated that they might do something or harm to themselves. We have to create an environment where we're honest with our children. They see a lot. They know a lot. I know we try to think that they don't, but they absolutely do, especially in the age of social media that we're in. And it behooves us to be honest with them and to listen, because they will tell, if you just ask students how they're feeling or what they're seeing, they will tell you, especially if you take the time to build trust with them, they will tell you. So I always err on the side of facts first, making sure they understand the harm and reality that is out there, and being prepared and being able, knowing what to do when there is an emergency, because it's more important for them to come home at night than to give some type of a false assurance that this won't happen to them.
It's Dr. Darian Driver Hudson, formerly the superintendent of schools in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She's now the CEO of United Way of Southeastern Michigan. When you talk to people who've worked on school violence and gun issues for a long time, they'll tell you part of the reason it's been difficult to move forward is a lack of data.
After the break, we're going to meet a researcher who's trying to give us a clearer picture of what's going on. We'll be right back.
Support for Michigan Public's Stateside podcast comes from Lake Trust Credit Union, working to empower financial well-being for Michigan consumers, businesses, and communities. Committed to financial solutions and advice to support people and families. More information at laketrust.org.
Support for the Stateside podcast comes from Kalamazoo College, offering a personalized education that combines critical thinking, curiosity, and creativity. Committed to preparing students for meaningful careers that make a positive impact on the world. More at kzoo.edu.
For some years, the United States has not funded very much research on young people and gun violence, despite the fact that so many children are hurt or killed every year because of guns. What do motive and reasoning and coping look like with children? Children who don't really have a fully developed brain until they're not even children anymore. The funding situation for research is starting to change, but there is still a long way to go. One of the researchers working in this field is Professor Mark Zimmerman. He's director of the Michigan Youth Violence Prevention Center and co-director of the Institute for Firearm Injury Prevention, and he's also a professor of public health, psychology, and education at the University of Michigan.
School shootings have been increasing over the last decade compared to the decades before that, and the pandemic hasn't certainly helped. That's been sort of adding gasoline to the fire. I think the pandemic has created isolation, has created stress in families and in kids, and it's just all coming to a head. When school reopened mostly across the United States, I mean, I know many schools stayed open, but for the schools that did close, many of the ones that reopened in the fall were talking about lots of violence more broadly, not just firearm violence, but lots of incidents of bullying and fighting. And I think partly the students did not have the chance to kind of practice social skills. They were mostly virtual. Maybe they were in some pods in their neighborhoods, but it sort of unleashed their reconnecting with people, and not always in the most positive ways. And this just, to me, speaks a lot to the importance of social emotional learning in our schools. An important part of growing up, an important part of our brain development, is learning how to talk to people, connect with people, make decisions. Most of the brain doesn't develop fully until about 25 years old. So when we think about an adolescent who's maybe 15, 17 years old, and we think, what were they thinking? The answer is they might not have been, because the frontal cortex isn't completely fully developed. So not all the neurons are firing as they might be in adults. And so that's why this idea of social emotional intelligence and learning is so important.
The shootings and the gun threats and gun sightings that we hear about the most and that seem to get the most attention tend to be the ones that more or less look like what happened in Oxford, a white community, a relatively affluent community. How reflective are these kinds of mass shooting events from the overall incidence of gun violence that touches children's lives?
Well, that's really a really good question. I mean, when a horrific event happens, like what happened in Oxford, often makes the headlines and becomes the major stories of the day, as they well should. But we do forget the slow drip of violence that occurs in schools with or without guns across the United States. There's lots of bullying. 1 in 5 kids in national studies report being bullied in school, cyber or in person. For gay, lesbian, transgender youth, that number goes up to 30%. 1 in 3 kids are reporting being bullied. So the thought that about a third, 30 to 40% of American homes have firearms in them, makes firearms accessible. But to be really clear, firearms are the tip of the iceberg. There's many factors that build up to that point. Like I said, the bullying, the isolation. And often they're the one-offs you don't hear so much about, where one kid brings a gun to school to threaten another kid or to protect themselves because they've been bullied, or shoots somebody for one reason or another. So it's important to think about safe gun storage, but also thinking about, it's not just about the kids themselves. It's also about the adults who kind of create the context where the kids are growing up.
We don't have information yet in the Oxford case about a motive. The alleged suspect and his parents are not speaking with the police right now. But how much do we know about the factors that drive young people to commit acts of violence, or maybe more specifically, acts of mass violence?
Well, the other issue about mass violence, just to be clear, again, as horrific as they are, they're actually still relatively rare. And different people define mass violence in different ways. Usually 3 to 4 people have to be killed. But there are other kinds of violences that occur, certainly. And as in the Oxford case, there were many injuries. But what are some of the underlying factors that might lead someone to come into a school and shoot the school? Over half of school shootings are usually somebody who went to that school or are currently students in that school. So I think if we kind of think about what's going on, we have to think about that school context, and we have to think about that family context, and we have to think about sort of the overall community context where those events are occurring. This isolated incident is sort of the culmination of other kinds of exposures, whether it's family neglect or violence in the family, whether it's exposures in the community, whether it's bullying in schools. All of these factors lead kids to feel like they have no other recourse, or that they are acting out in a way that is going to, obviously hurt other people, but that they're most likely intending to do just that. So some of these are underlying, which is why I talked earlier about the importance of social emotional learning, other strategies for how to cope with this. There are other kinds of interventions that happen in schools. I think it's really important when we look at this that we don't just do what we always do in the United States, I think, and that is immediately go and blame the child. As I just noted, if the brain isn't fully developed and they don't really have the skills and this is how they act, sometimes it's because they're modeling that behavior. They see it happening other places. They see it happening on TV, or they see it in the family, or they see it in their community, and they see that this solves problems. And so that's what that's their go-to. Some psychologists call that script theory. They get their scripts from people around them, people they care about or people they think about or see in their world. And that's their script for solving a problem. And so that's their go-to. The other important thing is the importance of storing guns safely in our homes. Ideally, the guns would be stored locked and unloaded, and that the ammunition would be also locked and in a different place from the firearms, making it doubly difficult for somebody who shouldn't be having access to that gun to get access to that gun.
Research on gun violence and young people has been hard to come by. It's difficult to fund, and it's not easy to conduct. But you're currently leading this group at the University of Michigan that's looking at how to prevent firearm violence among young people. And I know that you're working on community interventions in Muskegon, as well as in Washington, D.C. Can you tell us about the work that you're doing, maybe what the program designs look like?
In terms of the Institute, I think, through the work of colleagues here at the University of Michigan and the support of the president of the University of Michigan, the idea of establishing this institute is a way to address a 30-plus year almost moratorium on federal funding and federal attention to this problem of firearm violence in particular. Just to put it in perspective, we've spent billions of dollars both in industry and in federal funding and in foundation funding to reduce the number of car crash death. And we were successful over the last 30 years in reducing car crash death by about 70%. If that same kind of funding was attended to firearms, we can make similar inroads into reducing the number of firearm-related deaths, which is in 2017 surpassed the number of car crash deaths in the United States. The seas are somewhat parting. There is now been money that was set aside in the federal budgets for firearm violence at CDC and NIH. So we recently were funded to do a study in Muskegon, Michigan. It has two phases in it. One is an implementation study around a program for counseling in emergency departments. It's called Safer Teens. And so we're seeing if we can roll that out in the whole healthcare system in both Muskegon and Grand Rapids. So that's one part of the study. The other part is we're working with local community partners who are doing work around youth employment, youth engagement in community change, seeing if we can somehow codify what they're actually doing in a more formal way so it could be replicated across the country, and looking at firearm violence and other kinds of outcome violence more generally in Muskegon. And in Washington, D.C., we're working in a very similar kind of work. And through those programs there that they've created, both in Washington, D.C. and in Muskegon, we're trying to see if what they're doing is effective in terms of police incidents and in terms of firearm incidents in particular. And we're looking at how we can codify it so that small cities and large cities could potentially replicate similar youth programs.
Mark, what questions do you have about young people's access to guns?
Well, you know, again, I just keep coming back to the idea that the adults create the world that the kids live in. The fact that they have access to guns is our fault. So what preoccupies me is what we can do as adults to create a place, A, for where kids can't get access to the guns that they shouldn't have access to. And also, what are the context that makes a kid want to grab a gun and shoot somebody? It's sort of an odd thing to say, but I'm going to say it. We have over 300 million guns in private hands in the United States. We have about 35,000 to 40,000 deaths a year. Then we don't really know the injury in terms of that, but it's about 60 or 100,000 people injured by guns. So relatively speaking, it's, you know, most gun owners are doing the right things. They're safe. They're locking their guns. They're being responsible firearm owners. And the example I gave with the cars, it's notable that we were able to achieve reducing the number of deaths by 70% over 30 plus years of research and implementation of those projects. But we never took anybody's car away. In fact, cars got faster, they got safer, and people drive even more. And so the idea of vilifying gun owners is not necessarily the solution here. I think the ideas are what we can do to help kids have alternative strategies for dealing with conflicts or dealing with being bullied, thinking about how we create climates and cultures in schools where kids learn how to solve problems without being violent, you know, how to deal with your emotions, how to deal with your anger, how to deal with your frustrations, how to deal with your social relationships without needing a gun to do it. So I just think about how do we get people who own guns to be, who are not responsible, to be responsible, and what can we do to make sure that guns don't end up in other, in people's hands who they shouldn't end up in. But, you know, again, guns are the tip of the iceberg. We need to start at the beginning. There's an adage about prevention where two people are on a picnic by a river and somebody falls into the river and is screaming for help. And one of the people on the who were at the picnic run over to jump in the lake, the river, and bring them to shore. And as they're doing that, another person comes. They get the person ashore, go out and get the other person. They're constantly doing this till they're running into exhaustion. And now a few people are floating down. And the other guy is starting to walk away upstream. And the person in the water says, "Why are you not coming to help me?" And he said, "Well, I'm really walking upstream to see what's causing these people to fall in the lake, in the river in the first place. So the idea of firearm violence to me is the prevention of violence more generally than thinking about what is the context in which we're exposing our children to end up with that behavior. And you think about it, anybody who's had a child, language that you use, they use, we think it's so cute. And sometimes it's like, where they hear that? Well, they didn't, you know, it's not innate. They heard it from the people around them. It's the same thing. People, kids learn the behaviors from around them. And whether it's video games or television or their families or our political leaders, they the more they talk about this is the way to solve a problem, it's not surprising to me. In fact, it's very predictable that somebody might use a gun to solve a problem. So to me, it's like, what are those things upstream that we need to do? We're working on some of those. I talked about the work that we're doing in Muskegon and in Washington, D.C. We've done some work around greening where we work in communities that have high vacancy, empty lots, or abandoned buildings. Those tend to be places of crime hotspots where violence occurs. And where those places occur is not accidental. They're typically in lower income communities, often with people of color in them. And we work with communities to kind of take back those properties and create a busy street instead of a broken window to show that people are paying attention in this space. And we're finding that that does reduce violence and reduces firearm violence. We call that busy streets, applying busy streets theory, creating places for people to feel proud of, where they might make a community garden or they might make a small park. But what they do is they work with each other and with local institutions, whether that's a land bank or a community organization or a neighborhood association, to sort of take back their communities and to make the place that they live a more pleasant place to be. That sends a message both to people who might be doing nefarious things, but also helps people feel better about their neighborhood. So I think about those kinds of things that we can do upstream.
And that's the Stateside Podcast for today. I'm April Baer. You can find full Stateside episodes at michiganradio.org. Our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Today's episode was produced by Aaron Allen. Other producers on our show are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, and April Van Buren. Our theme music is by 14KT, additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you're hanging in there. See you next time.